All right, good morning, everybody. It is now Tuesday morning, April 20th, and we are doing lecture this morning rather than lab lecture, and because I've got a doctor's appointment this afternoon that's conflicting with our normal lecture time, so we're just going to switch things up a little bit this morning. We're going to start aromaticity. That's the cool thing. So we are breaking out of, we're starting the next transition. So we started within the chemistry and looking at where we came out of alkenes and alkyne chemistry and making new carbon-carbon bonds. We went into the formation of alcohols and oxidations into carbonyls and looking at how to actually react with carbonyls using organometallics and Grignards and organolithium compounds. We did all kinds of synthesis. So that's where we went after that. And then we went into spectroscopy and did NMR and mass spec and IR and all of that structural ascertainment stuff, which was really cool. And now we start the transition back into the chemistry, back into actually looking at chemical reactions. And we start off by looking at aromaticity. And let me go ahead and do the screen share. And then we can really get into this. So I'm excited about this because it's always fun when you start aromaticity, because you think you know everything. I mean, it seems like you've been doing organic chemistry for almost two complete semesters now, which is a long time. And you've been looking at all different facets of how chemicals react. And we started off in Chem 12A by looking at bonding and what actually makes a chemical bond, and looking at hybridization and the atomic orbitals and hybrid orbitals and then molecular orbitals and this whole idea of how things go together. And it seems like right now we have a pretty good grasp on how things go together. And we're starting to understand this chemical reactivity and electron withdrawing groups and electron donating groups and what makes a nucleophile, what makes an electrophile, all this language that we've worked on and recognizing what these entities are. We've dealt with acid base and we've dealt with just all kinds of reactivity so far. And what we've done in all of that is we've dealt with aliphatic and aromatic, just bringing these two terms in. We dealt with these terms within spectroscopy, and we said that anything that was aliphatic, the definition here of aliphatic, was basically something that is not aromatic, which is a funny definition. So when we think about something that is aliphatic, you know, we think about molecules that may have longer chains or carbonyls, or maybe they have alcohols. All of this stuff is aliphatic, meaning not aromatic. So what is aromatic then? What is the definition of aromatic? Well, the definition is not simple. Well, maybe it is. It's not so difficult. It's just that we haven't dealt with it yet. So far, our definition of what aromatic is has been benzene. And we know that benzene has some special stability properties. It's very stable. Does not react like the aliphatic molecules that we've been looking at. Does not do SN1, SN2, E1, E2. It doesn't do these types of reactions. It resists these types of reactions. And you could say, well, maybe that's because these are all sp2 hybridized carbons, and sp2s don't generally do that. But there are other things that aromaticity resists that normal molecules do not. For instance, if we take a double bond and we treat this double bond with any number of reagents, right? So we could look at, these were the substitution reactions. in order to produce, electrophilic substitution. Right, so we could do HBr. And when doing HBr, we could get both this guy, plus we could get the hydride shift, is what we would expect, that this one would be major, right? We could take and we could look at doing HBr with this guy, and there's no reaction. We could take and we could look at doing hydrogenation, H2 and platinum, and we would hydrogenate that and get the saturated alkane. You could take the aromatic molecule, benzene, and do the same reaction, H2 and platinum, and you get no reaction. There are many examples that we could show that were all the electrophilic substitution reactions or electrophilic addition. And none of them work on benzene. So what is it about benzene that makes it so unique and so special? And then why do we have an entire chapter on aromaticity if it's just benzene? So these are some of the questions that we want to deal with that are interesting. And you know, to make this even a little bit more interesting, what we see is that if we look at, you know, we have the differences in the stability of the alkenes, and we can measure the stability of an alkene if we take and we look at the most stable alkene. The most stable alkene that we know of is a tetrasubstituted. And so if we're looking at, see if I can get things to snap in here, this is increasing stability. And we go from that tetrasubstituted to a trisubstituted, to a disubstituted, which is trans, or a disubstituted, which is cis, disubstituted, which is geminal. We would then go to monosubstituted and unsubstituted, that they get less stable of a bond as we get less substituted. Well, how are we measuring that stability? One of the ways in which we're measuring that stability is to take two molecules which are isomers of one another and to hydrogenate them and look at the energy of hydrogenation that comes out. So one of the ways that we can do that is we can take a molecule and we'll take the same framework and we will add in a monosubstituted and a trisubstituted, right? And then what we do is we hydrogenate these. And when we hydrogenate them, we add hydrogen plus platinum, and we look at the energy that comes out being exothermic reactions. Because what we're doing energy-wise is in these hydrogenations, we're going to a more stable product. And we're going to the same structure. We're going to the same. If we put like a baseline here and we say these are the products that we're making thermodynamically, we're going to the same product in each case. And so we can compare the amount of energy that comes out, and the amount of energy that comes out tells us how stable things are. And what we find is that when we do this hydrogenation, that this molecule here, the amount of energy that comes out is a lot less than the amount of energy that comes out over here. And so we would say that this molecule is less stable. It has more energy stored in the bonds that is released upon hydrogenation than the trisubstituted, okay? In the same sort of way, we can take molecules that have multiple pi bonds, and we can compare the amount of energy within those multiple pi bonds. So that one way of looking at this is to take, take a molecule that is a long chain. And with that long chain, let's say that we're looking at One, two, three. This will work, I believe. Say that we're looking at something like this. And what we want to do is we want to hydrogenate this. So I'm going to move it down. And if I hydrogenate this and add hydrogen with platinum to it, I reach sort of this baseline that we'll draw down here, where I make the saturated alkane and I can measure the amount of energy that comes out of here. If I take the same molecule and I put multiple bonds into the molecule, so that what I'm dealing with is something that maybe looks like this, then what we expect when we hydrogenate this molecule is that the energy that comes out upon hydrogenation, it takes two equivalents of hydrogen. And the platinum, but the amount of energy that comes out, if we call this X, then this would be 2X. Because we're hydrogenating two of the alkenes. And so it should require twice the amount of energy in order to reach the same product. That makes sense, right? What happens when we conjugate the system? Notice that right now there's an sp3 hydrogen or sp3 carbon just in here that has two hydrogens in it. So the system is not conjugated. And it's not cumulated. It's isolated. That's the way that we want to say it. This is an isolated system. But what we can do is we can take and we can conjugate that. And as we conjugate it, we come out with a system that looks like this. And as we conjugate that system, the system becomes more stable. We still can do the two equivalents of hydrogen and platinum, and we can still come out to the same product down here. But what we find is that this is less than two times the amount of energy that's coming out of this. And what that is that the difference in the energies that are in the system is the energy that is the stabilization of conjugation. And so we could say here that if we're sort of looking at the energy difference here, and I look at the energy difference that is here, this is the energy that is that the system is more stable by and is the energy that is decreased for the system. The system is more stable. And we could say that this is the energy that is gained by conjugation. Well, if we take a look at an aromatic system, the aromatic system becomes even more interesting, because what we would expect for an aromatic system is that if we take an alkene that has three bonds in it, and we look at the amount of energy that it would take to hydrogenate this guy. So this is conjugated. And we think about the amount of energy that's required to do three equivalents of hydrogen and platinum. And we come down to this baseline and we get the saturated molecule. It's so hard when you start drawing double bonds not to draw them. Okay, and we say that this energy is three times the energy for just a regular double bond, but it's slightly less than that, because actually maybe what I'll do is I'll make all three, because this system is conjugated. So what we would say here is that maybe this is three times just the alkene and three equivalents of H2 and platinum. And then what happens is you take a look at the aromatic system, and the aromatic system is yet more stable than the conjugated system. We can actually calculate how much more stable it is, and it's dramatically more stable. There we go. Okay. So this is much more stable. It's more stable than the conjugation. And so aromaticity is not simple conjugation, if that makes sense. Aromaticity is something that is more stable than conjugation itself. And I know I haven't done any numbers. I've done it sort of in a hand-waving way. But if we put the numbers to it, it's dramatically more stable. And the question is, well, why is it dramatically more stable? If it's not simple conjugation, then it's not simple resonance. So we would say here, not simple resonance or conjugation. That there's more going on under the hood than simple resonance or conjugation, which means that we need to go to a new theory. We need to reach to something new in order to understand what aromatic is. So let me give you some examples of things that there are some interesting molecules that demonstrate the properties of aromaticity. So I could just give you the rules of aromaticity, but I think it's more interesting not to have the rules yet, but to look at some molecules that demonstrate what aromatic actually is. And I think it's important to also state, as I start to draw these, that aromaticity, when you say the word aromaticity, aromaticity or something that is aromatic has a different common meaning within the English language. To say that something is aromatic within the English language invokes the idea that it has a particular smell to it, right? So we think of certain herbs as being aromatic. We could say that thyme or rosemary or certain types of stretching for language this morning. My brain is not entirely awake. Certain smells invoke a nature of aromaticity or aromatic. And that aromatic is not to be confused with aromaticity, because the compounds that are aromatic, while they have particular odors to them, and some of them may be very strong, they're not oftentimes pleasant smelling. And aromatic is not about how something smells. The word or definition of aromatic within chemistry is a certain arrangement of electrons and a certain arrangement of the molecule structure that gives it greater stability. And that's what our definition is that we're working with. So it has nothing to do with smell in terms of aromatics. I wanted to hit that real quick. All right, so of course, we know that benzene is aromatic. I don't know why I'm having trouble drawing. I'm gonna switch glasses. Maybe that will help slow me down. I think it's also, I'm so used to drawing while sitting that I'm still struggling while standing sometimes. Okay, some other common aromatic molecules. There are aromatic molecules which contain other atoms besides carbon. Nitrogen, for instance. We can have an aromatic molecule that contains nitrogen in it. And you say, all right, well, you know, that looks a lot like the benzene. You've just put a nitrogen in there. It still has all of the double bonds and everything looks the same. So we could understand and see that those two are aromatic. But it doesn't have to be a six-membered ring system. In fact, there are five-membered ring systems which demonstrate aromaticity. So a five-membered ring system can demonstrate aromaticity. That guy, furan, can demonstrate aromaticity. We can have five-membered ring systems that have multiple heteroatoms. So we can take, and actually, before we do that, let's do this one. This guy demonstrates aromaticity. Or we can have two heteroatoms. Where the molecule can be aromatic. So all of these molecules are aromatic. So it can be five-membered rings or six-membered rings in different combinations. We can add to this. We can actually go up to, I was going to do a seven-membered ring system, and I can, but when I go up to seven-membered ring systems, I have to do something a little tricky. So in a seven-membered ring system, in order to get it to be aromatic, I have to use either, I'll do it this way, because this guy would be aromatic. We'll put a boron in it. That guy is aromatic, which is interesting. So I can find ways in order to convert seven-membered ring systems to aromatic. I can extend beyond this, and I can go to smaller ring systems as well and seven-member ring systems by doing this. Ionic things can be aromatic. So here's a seven-membered ring system that is aromatic, or I can go to a five-membered ring system with a carbon in it that has a negative charge. You can go to four-membered ring systems and make things that are aromatic, or three-membered ring systems. And all of these things demonstrate a stability greater than what would normally be thought of as the stability for these types of molecules. What's interesting is that some of these, we can draw things that are not aromatic. For instance, things that are not aromatic, let's do it this way. This guy looks like it should be aromatic. It fits sort of the idea of what's going on over here. We have six pi electrons, all sp2 hybridized, all arc alternating. So it looks like it's fully conjugated. And in fact, if you look at all of these systems are fully conjugated in terms of their electrons. And this one looks like it's fully conjugated, but it doesn't demonstrate the properties of aromaticity. In fact, it's more reactive than it would be predicted to be looking at its structure alone. And because it's actually more reactive and not less reactive, it's actually anti-aromatic, which is fascinating to think about. Some other systems which are anti-aromatic. That guy is anti-aromatic. And that guy is anti-aromatic. While we might predict them to be very stable and fully conjugated like some of the other systems, they actually aren't. And so there's something deeper going on that we need to reach for to start to understand these systems. And so you can start to see that aromaticity is a much more fascinating type of chemistry that's going on here than just benzene ring systems. So let's describe in words what is aromaticity. What is the definition of an aromatic molecule? Aromatic molecules are flat. They are all sp2 hybridized. For the ring system, they have a number of electrons that fit the formula. Four N plus two, where N equals an integer value. It's not the number of anything. I was going to say the number of something, but it is just an integer value. And so what this formula tells us is it tells us the number of electrons that are required in order to get an aromatic system. So if we take that 4n plus 2, and then we look at the value of n, and the value that n can take, which are integer values. So these are the number of electrons allowed for aromatic. It must also comply with the other, must be entirely flat, must be all conjugated. So that's what this term is meaning here. This is meaning conjugated. It must meet those other two terms, flat, all sp2 hybridized, but it also must have this 4n plus 2 pi electrons. And so integer values could be 0, 1, 2, 3, so on. And so the number of electrons that would fit this, if we stick in 0 for n, we get 4 times 0 plus 2, that's going to equal 2. So 2 electrons, any system that meets flat all sp2 hybridized atoms within the ring, and it has 2 pi electrons. And I should say that these are the number of not only electrons allowed for aromatic, but the number of pi electrons. So we're only looking at the pi system. So I need to move electrons over too. So we'll put pi electrons in there. Have a number of pi electrons that fit the formula 4n plus 2. So we'll have to look at just the double bond electrons, just the pi electrons. 4 times 1 plus 2 is 6. So 6 electrons fit that bill. 4 times 2 is 8 plus 2 is 10. 10 electrons, 10 pi electrons would fit that bill. 3, 12, 14. 14 electrons would fit that bill. And we don't go up to great high numbers because the higher in number you go, the harder it is to maintain a molecule that is flat and rigid, and the molecule starts to become floppy. And as the molecule starts to become floppy, as soon as it bends, you break conjugation, and breaking conjugation breaks aromaticity. So we tend to only stay really within 0, 1, 2, and 3, although other larger systems can be aromatic in nature. Okay. So when we take a look at some of these systems then, and we go back and we look at benzene, and I want to draw the pi electrons in separately. So I'm going to draw a couple of molecules here first and then come back in and put in the pi electrons. And let me get pyrrole in here too. Oops. Okay, so this is going to be benzene. This one is pyridine. This one's thiophene. And pyrrole. Two R's in pyrrole. Okay, and the system of electrons . Okay, so what I've done is some of the electrons I've highlighted in black and some of the electrons I've highlighted in red. And what I'm looking at is the number of pi electrons. In the system. And we'll see that there's 6 pi electrons, just counting 2, 4, 6, each of the double bonds has 2 electrons in that system, in that pi system. And so you add them all up, you get 6 pi electrons. We could do similar here, 2, 4, 6, 2, 4, 6, 2, 4, 6 for the lone pair. So all of these have 6 pi electrons in these systems. You say, wait a minute, whoa, hold on. You're being selective here. You're counting some pi electrons and you're not counting other pi electrons. So how is it that you can be selective about counting the pi electrons that you want to count? How does that make something aromatic or not aromatic? Well, that's an interesting question. And we have to look at the orbital symmetries and what is actually going on within these molecules to understand that. So we have to go to molecular orbital theory and look at molecular orbital theory to start to grasp and handle why we can count some pi electrons and why others can't be counted. So the counting of electrons who gets counted and who does not, counting of electrons is about molecular orbital theory. And which electrons are in the pi system. Some electrons are in that pi system and some are not. And we have to know the orbital shapes and understand where those orbitals reside, what they look like, in order to understand how we can count some and not others. So first off, let's take a look a little bit at some of these molecules and their geometries and shapes and their orbitals and how these orbitals may look. Okay, so when we look at benzene, benzene's a little bit easier. You know, we have this idea of what benzene looks like. We take and each one of the orbitals that are here, and I'm gonna go and put the back lobes down in here. I just wanna make sure that I sort of had room to fit them in. These orbitals on benzene, let's slide this over just so that we have a good idea of what it is that I'm trying to show you here. The system has molecular orbitals that we can draw. And we can think about these as just the orbitals of the pi system itself. So these will be the molecular orbitals of pi system. And when we look at that pi system, there are 6 carbons, and there are 6 p orbitals, which are used to comprise the entire pi system. So remember that when we look at an alkene and we think about the bonding within the alkene, the way that bonding is structured is that you have one of these bonds, which is the sigma bond, and the other bond represents the pi bond. The sigma bond, if we think about the sigma bond, the sigma is comprised of taking the sp2 hybrid, and on the other carbon, taking the sp2 hybrid and overlapping them such that they come together to form the sigma bond. And that sigma bond then has a geometry or shape that has a little back lobe out here and a little back lobe out here. And this would be the bonding orbital, not the anti-bonding orbital. We also get the sigma star. This is a good time to remind you guys that we get both. So we also, get the anti-bonding orbital. And the anti-bonding orbital looks like this. We get a lobe and a back lobe out of this, and a lobe and a back lobe out of this. And color-wise, I don't need a calculator, color-wise, we would get red and blue, and for the occupied orbitals, and green and yellow for the unoccupied orbitals. And they would look something like that. This is the sigma star bond, the antibonding. But the pi bond is constructed differently. So the pi bond uses the p orbitals. And I haven't really gotten my p orbitals large enough, but essentially what happens is the p orbitals overlap. And as the p orbitals overlap, they construct the pi bond. And that pi bond is made not from sp2 hybrids, but from atomic p orbitals. Is all of this ringing a bell? Is this coming back to you slowly? Sort of just checking how everybody's doing here. Nobody's got cameras on. Drew's giving me a yes, that's cool. Thank you, appreciate that. With the pi bond, what happens is when these guys come together, they can come together in the pi bonding orbital, in which case what we get is we get the two sort of, I always call them Twinkies, because they look like Twinkies above and below the plane, one of them being red in phase. So remember that the color is dealing with phase, the other being blue in phase. Red and blue correspond to plus and minus. You could ascribe plus or minus to either color, doesn't really matter, but they're just demonstrating phase of the standing wave. Yellow and green are also plus and minus, but they symbolize unoccupied. They symbolize an orbital that has no electron density in it and represents the antibonding orbital. And for a carbon-carbon pi bond, we would similarly get an antibonding orbital. This would be the pi star. That would be alternating in colors, green and yellow, and has its electron density thrown towards the outside of the bonds where it's not actually holding anything together. So we get the bonding and the antibonding. Okay. This is the molecular orbitals for the pi system itself, which means that these are all of the pi bonds and these are all of the pi star bonds. And when you put six electrons into this system, the six electrons that go into the system sit in these orbitals here. This is called psi one. This is called psi two. This is called psi three. These are the wave function names, psi four, psi five, and psi six. And because you put six p orbitals into the system, you get six pi orbitals coming out of the system, three which are bonding, and three, which are antibonding. Okay, And so when we look at that system, these orbitals will have different shapes associated with the bonding and different shapes associated with antibonding. And we can go and we can look at them. But the important thing to understand here is that these orbitals, particularly in the first bonding level, are all conjugated. And it's very hard to draw sort of what happens here, but you can imagine that in psi one, if I were to look at psi one, which is the easiest one to understand, psi one has a ring of electron density that is red at the top. This is the upper lobe, and it's like a giant pi bond. And the bottom lobe has the blue color, which extends all throughout that bottom lobe. And so it's like a giant pi bond in the way that it is fully conjugated and essentially has two lobes associated with it. Now, as I go to psi two and psi three, I get more nodes because as you go higher in energy, you get more nodes. I'm not prepared to draw all of those just yet. But the important thing to understand here is that the pi bonds or the p orbitals that go into this system are all aligned such that they can overlap and that all the electrons within this system can move throughout the system freely throughout all of the orbitals within the system. Okay, so what that means is that these p orbitals are all perpendicular to the ring system and aligned parallel to one another, if we think about it in that way. When we start to look at some of these other systems that have lone pairs in them, let's take the pyridine and look at the pyridine, for instance. Pyridine would be very similar to benzene, except for the nitrogen and the lone pair. So where we take a look at benzene, and we say, right, well, benzene, if we look at it on the flat, so here's my benzene on the flat, and I put in my orbitals. I'm going to leave the back lower ones. I'm leaving the back lower lobes for these out just for clarity because I don't want it to obstruct the image. When I draw the one with nitrogen in it, and I'll put nitrogen on the right-hand side, what happens here with the nitrogen on the right-hand side is that nitrogen has one set of electrons . This one's a little bit easier to draw in the way that I've drawn it. Nitrogen has one set of electrons that are the double bond. Let's see if I can color coordinate. So this set that is here would be the electrons that are there, and this set resides in an orbital that extends out this direction, orthogonal, or I should say, in the same plane as the ring system. And this is the lone pair of nitrogen on nitrogen, and that extends outwards. And this is an sp2 hybrid. That the lone pair is extending into, while these are atomic p orbitals that are being used to construct the pi bond. And we'll say pi system. So you can see that because the geometry of this orbital, which extends out away from the ring in the plane of the ring, is not being brought into the system itself, that these lone pair of electrons are not part of the pi system. Okay, so what happens when I have a hetero atom that has two lone pairs on it? If we go back to the thiophene or pyrrole, pyrrole's a little bit easier to, well, no, let's do thiophene because thiophene has two lone pairs. So thiophene's a good example. Let's go ahead and take the thiophene, and or we could do furan with oxygen that has two, and that's a great one as well. So maybe oxygen and the furan is a good molecule to do. So furan, same thing as thiophene, has two lone pairs in the system and is aromatic. And I get to count two of those electrons, two lone pairs in that system, but not that guy. So, and maybe my color choice here is poor because it looks like I'm doing orbitals. And I should be aware of the fact that I'm not doing orbitals. So if I want to be aware that I'm not doing orbitals, I'll say that those are within the system and these guys are not part of the system. So my color coding is not for orbitals per se, but for which ones are within the pi system and which ones are not. Let's take a look at that five-membered ring system and see why that is the case and how that happens. In the five-membered ring system, the whole system is flat. And we come up to an oxygen. We'll do it this way. We have the pi double bonds that are here, which means that these systems here put that guy in the back there. And the oxygen has two lone pairs of electrons. One pair of the electrons resides in a p orbital, and the other in an sp2 hybrid. And so what's happening is the oxygen is sp2 hybridized. And because it is sp2 hybridized, it is getting this one, which is constructed of sp2 hybrids, this one, which is constructed of sp2 hybrids, and this one, which is the remaining sp2 hybrid, which gets the remaining electron. And so if we take a look at that oxygen itself, that oxygen has, you know, if we think about this as sort of an XYZ system, and this is Z, we'll call this X, and we'll call this Y, then there is a system of electrons here that this is the p orbital. There is an sp2 hybrid that has a little lobe. So this is an sp2 hybrid that sits there. And then there's an sp2 hybrid that comes out this way and an sp2 hybrid that goes back along that way. And these guys here are both sp2 hybrids. And the bond angle between these is 120 degrees. Now that bond angle is not exactly 120 degrees in the furan because of the constrained ring system. It bends it a little bit. That also puts a little bit higher coefficient out on this sp2 hybrid that resides out here. But the fact is that these guys all remain in the same plane. And this one is 90 degrees perpendicular to that plane. So the angle here between this guy and this guy is a 90 degree angle that resides between that orbital, which is on the Z axis and on the X axis. And so what we get is we get the pi system. I'll do it this way, I guess. We get the pi system, which is here and here. And this guy, which resides in that pi system, and then this one, which is outside of the pi system. And so I can count two of these electrons as part of this pi system, and the other two electrons are outside of it, simply because of the geometry of the orbitals themselves and which ones are located within the pi and which ones are not. Is that making sense? Am I drawing well enough here in order to get sort of the geometries that I'm talking about? I'm not getting any questions, so I'm assuming that I'm on a roll here and everything's going okay.
I'm a little rusty on, like, I guess, molecular orbitals. So while the words make sense, like applying them is a little rickety. Like, yeah. I don't think I'd be able to predict that that's an sp2 orbital on the oxygen.
Well, in actuality, you would not be able to. So that's I love that question, because it's not that you're necessarily rusty. It's that I'm doing something different with it than is expected. So let's take what we know and let's work from that question and show why what I'm doing looks different than what we would expect. So here, let's do expectation based on everything that we've learned. The expectation is that if I look at furan and I were to ask you guys to tell me about this molecule and to tell me about the hybridization of the oxygen, the expectation is that you would say, oh, this thing would look something like this. We would say that the oxygen would be sp1, p2, p3. We would say that the oxygen would be sp3 hybridized. And you might expect that this oxygen being sp3 hybridized would have the rabbit ears sort of orbitals, and that this guy would be sp3 hybrids. And that sp3 hybrid nature, which is simply come from counting the bonds in the way that we would normally do, and saying that this has four things attached to it. Give me one second. My dogs are really making it difficult for me to concentrate. And we have construction going on across the street, and I think that that's what they're keying into. I'm just going to go stick them in the bedroom for a second so that I can actually function. So give me 30 seconds here. All right, there's only so much barking you can take. All right, so when we look at an atom like this, I mean, the expectation is that we were looking at something that might be akin to water, right? And so water is something that we're familiar with. And when we look at water, we expect that water has the rabbit ears and would be sp3 hybridized. And because it's sp3, we get bond angles of 109.5, right? And so that's sort of our expectation. And what I'm doing is not along the lines of that expectation. What I'm doing is I'm telling you that hybridization as you know it is not correct. I mean, let's think about along the lines of expectation, how we learned about hybridization, right? So when you were in Chem 3 or Chem 1A or even Chem 1B, what you worked on was VSEPR theory, valence shell electron pair repulsion theory. And within that valence shell electron pair repulsion theory, all we simply did was count the number of atoms in lone pairs. And when we counted the atoms and the lone pairs attached to an atom, that told us what the hybridization was that we were going to expect to see, right? And so we could do something like water, where we had four things. A thing being, excuse me, a thing being a lone pair or an atom. And so we had the four things attached to it. And we would say that this is not SP3. We wouldn't use that language. We would use tetrahedral. And if we had something that had only three things attached to it, let's say like formaldehyde, and we're looking at the central carbon, then we learned to ignore double bonds and just take a look at the number of atoms that were attached, or the other one that was common to see at this time was sulfur dioxide. And that had the two oxygens and the lone pairs. And this had three things. Because this had three things, we would say that this was trigonal planar. And likewise, you know, we could do two things and we would get linear. And so we had all the geometries that came out of VSEPR theory, and we used that standardly for Chem 3, Chem 1A, Chem 1B, and it all worked. Everything was just like, yes, this is easy. And then you hit Chem 12. And then in Chem 12A, what we started to do is we started to look at natural bonding theory. And I don't know if Zaruba called it that, but we looked at natural bonding theory and we looked at molecular orbital theory. The difference between the two, between natural bonding theory and molecular orbital theory, is that natural bonding theory deals with localized bonds. Whereas molecular orbital theory is delocalized. Those are the biggest differences. Otherwise, they do almost essentially the same thing, except what natural bonding theory does is natural bonding theory allows me to do hybridizations. And so that hybridization idea of being able to take atomic orbitals, hybridize them, and then add them together allowed me to get all the geometries. And essentially, out of those geometries came sp3, sp2, sp hybridizations. And then we started to link sp3 and sp2 and sp to our standard geometries that we understood. You know, sp3 is tetrahedral, sp2 is trigonal planar. SP is linear. And so we had a different language then to use to describe, and it allowed us to understand how the electrons were being arranged in order to get different geometries. We sort of did that. When we did that, if Zaruba didn't use natural bonding theory, he couched it under molecular orbital theory. But molecular orbital theory doesn't deal with hybridizations in the same way that natural bonding theory does. The way that I think of natural bonding theory is that natural bonding theory sort of sits over VSEPR theory and is where VSEPR theory came out of. Now, VSEPR theory was a very useful theory, but it was very limited. It only allowed us to be able to predict geometries for things that followed the rules. And there was things that didn't follow the rules. Natural bonding theory allowed us to then figure out which things broke the rules and to be able to come up with some different ideas. Natural bonding theory is now failing us. As we get into molecular orbital theory, that natural bonding theory, if we followed it strictly, would predict or expect that the furan, the oxygen in the furan, should be tetrahedral in its geometry, and this thing should be bent and puckered and not flat at all, and I should get rabbit ears on this, and that's just not the case. And so what we're saying is that we need to reach beyond natural bonding theory, and we need to reach into molecular orbital theory to start to understand this. And the underlying fundamental property or principle is that the molecule doesn't hybridize in the way that we have liked to say. That geometry is linked to stability, and stability is linked to electronic configuration, and that the geometry of the molecule and the electronic configuration of the molecule will assume whatever is the most stable configuration, and that geometry is governed by stability, by electronic stability, and that this whole idea of orbitals repelling one another while they do, a bigger factor is the configuration and the stability of the configuration itself, and that atoms will undertake a geometry that allows them to be more stable that may not align with VSEPR theory. And we see that all the time. One of the biggest places that we see it that I don't know that we've talked about, but if you take, and I ask you, and I give you an amine, let's say that this has a CH3 group on it, a lone pair, and two hydrogens. Can you tell me what geometry the nitrogen should be? So by geometry, you could either tell me hybridization, or you could tell me geometry shape. You could give me the name of the shape that this thing could assume. And it could either be the electronic geometry, or it could be the molecular geometry. And I will take either, and we'll put it in this. So Drew's giving me sp3, and I would agree with that, that sp3 would be one way that I would describe this. Trigonal pyramidal, JC, is absolutely correct. That would be the molecular geometry. And then if I wanted the electronic geometry, anybody could tell me what the electronic geometry is? That's the geometry where we could see tetrahedral, JC, correct. All right, I like that I had a whole myriad of people answering my questions in there. That's excellent. Showing me that everybody's online with what we're doing here. So let's be clear what all those things are for everybody. What we're saying here is that the nitrogen would have one group that way, one group this way, and one group back. And so this would be the second hydrogen. This would be the CH3 group, and that the lone pair would reside in an sp3 hybrid. Okay, and that's all correct. And so we would say that the nitrogen is sp3 in hybridization, that the atomic geometry, or I should say the molecular geometry, would be trigonal pyramidal, and that the electronic geometry would be tetrahedral. So the electronic geometry is the governing geometry, the geometry that tells me how many things there are overall. There's four things, and so that's tetrahedral. The molecular geometry is telling me that I can only see those things which are the, so let's do it this way. Let's take and say, here's that guy. And then there's what I can actually see of the molecule. So the molecule actually has those atoms that are there. The molecular geometry just tells me about seeing those atoms that I could see, but the electronic geometry involves both. It involves both the lone pair and the atoms, and that allows me to tell that the overall sort of geometry is tetrahedral, and that gives me the idea of the bond angles here, that the bond angles are 109.5. Okay, everything's working great. My world is perfect. Everything that I've learned is in line with the universe, and nobody's messing with my view of reality until somebody messes with my view of reality. Okay, so tell me about this nitrogen. This is an amide nitrogen. And I'm curious to know the same sort of information. I want to know what is my hybridization of the nitrogen, and I want to know what is my molecular geometry around the nitrogen, and what is my electronic geometry around the nitrogen. So let's start with hybridization. Who can tell me what the hybridization of that nitrogen is? sp3. And you arrived at sp3 because you used the exact same concept that we used above. That when we looked at here and we used VSEPR theory, that VSEPR theory gave me all of those things. So VSEPR theory down here would say that this thing is SP3. But here's the observation. When you measure the bond angles, what we find is that the nitrogen is not SP3. And in fact, the bond angles here are 120 degrees. And so by observation, when I look at this thing spectroscopically and I measure the bond angle spectroscopically, I find that the bond angles are 120 degrees and that it is not SP3, but it is actually SP2 hybridized. And so this is reality. Reality says it's SP2. Now, why is it SP2? Well, we can understand that it's SP2 if we think about the lone pair that resides on this nitrogen. Let me do it in a different drawing. I don't want to convolute that drawing. Let's take it down here. Let's try to understand why. The why has to do with the lone pair, in that the lone pair resides here, and that this is the pi system for the carbonyl. And that the pi system for the carbonyl is conjugated with the system for the nitrogen. The entire system is conjugated and through conjugation becomes more stable. That can only happen if the nitrogen becomes SP2 and throws the lone pair into a p orbital as opposed to an SP3 orbital, an SP3 hybrid. So this is not SP3 hybrid. It's a p orbital. And that p orbital allows the system to be in conjugation to make it more stable. So structure is driven by stability, not by simple repulsion from electron groups. That there are more important factors than simple repulsion within systems. There is also energy stability, which is gained through conjugation, through the stability of the arrangement of the electrons. And this system, as we're going here, we could predict through resonance. So we could take and we could draw the resonance of the system, right? And so in looking at the resonance, we might be able to predict this if I took and understood that the nitrogen lone pair was in resonance with the system. And then I could draw this. However, resonance alone doesn't solve the problem. Although you need to understand that in order for this lone pair to resonate into that bond, that the orbitals must be aligned to allow electron flow from one orbital to the next. If this orbital is out of alignment from this one, and they are in different planes, then being in different planes would not allow the overlap. And you break the conjugation. The conjugation is broken, right? This is the same thing. This is the same thing that when I have an alkene that looks like this, there is no interconversion between these two systems. Because in order to interconvert, what I would need to do is take a flat planar system that has a pi bond And in order to break it, I would have to twist the system. So one orbital now would be going sort of wonky out sideways as this system is twisting. The other one is still in line. Let's see if I can exaggerate that a little bit more. And the conjugation here is broken. This is the pi bond, which is broken and requires an extreme amount of energy in order for that to happen when those two go out of plane. And so it simply doesn't happen. Likewise, in order for these lone pairs to be conjugated at all times with this system, they have to be in a pi bond, which is in the same plane. If that pi bond goes out of that plane, then it breaks conjugation. And it takes a tremendous amount of energy to do that. The systems that we've been looking at up here, all the way back up here, the Furan system, where we're looking at the differences between these two lone pairs, how can these two lone pairs be different, has to do with molecular orbital theory and the stability of these lone pairs being in different types of orbitals in different locations, one of them being within the pi system, one of them being outside the pi system. And the oxygen arranges in this configuration for the stability of the system overall in order to make the system aromatic. Aromaticity can be a driving factor for geometry, for structure, similar to the way that we looked at VSEPR theory, but we have to understand how to use it. We have to understand what it is that actually makes something aromatic. So when we said that something was aromatic, we came up with these rules, right? We said the system must be flat, must be all sp2 hybridized, must have a number of pi electrons that fit the formula that is the 4n plus 2 pi electrons. All right, the biggest one is this one. Where did this formula come from? And why does that make something aromatic? We need to go to yet another sort of concept in order to visualize the molecular orbitals and understand it from a molecular orbital theory principle. Okay, so if everybody's still with me, and hopefully, I think it was Chase. No, it was Kelly who was asking the question. I don't know. I lost track of who asked the question. I apologize.
They were one and the same.
JC, thank you. I can tell by voice. As soon as I hear the voice, I know who asked the question. It's looking back at the name and trying to link the name because I've got a name and I don't have faces. Oh, people, that's okay. I'm fine with that. I'm not bitter or grumpy. The question was an excellent question. And we need to understand deeper into molecular orbital theory why something becomes more stable. So I think, JC, did I answer the question to a better degree and help you sort of grapple with these ideas a little bit better, I hope?
I think so. I'm definitely hanging on. Okay. That did help because it was like, oh, I remembered Vesper very well. This was just new.
Right. That's the thing. And so that's what I wanted to do is I want to validate the Vesper approach, but also say we need to go beyond it. And so Vesper is not going to be your guiding principle here. Vesper is just going to get you in deep, deep trouble because we have reached the limits of Vesper. And like, this is the thing about teaching as well with an understanding of the curriculum all the way through. Most of the time when we're teaching Vesper within Chem 1A, Chem 1B, Chem 3, all of those things, the teacher who's teaching that understands that it's a limited principle, but it's the best model that we have at that point that is useful at that point. And it is extraordinarily useful. It predicts everything that's within that curriculum. We know it's going to fail, but we leave it to the next teacher to explain why it fails, how it fails, and how to put it in context and understand it. And so the thing is there is that we're not afraid to teach a model as long as the model is useful. And as long as at some point we start to explain the limitations of the model and the next model that comes after it. And there is always layers to models that we reach the usefulness of a model and we start to move into the next model system that explains it. And a perfect example of that is acids and bases, right? You started off with the Arrhenius definition. You move from the Arrhenius definition, which was only in water, to Bronsted-Lowry. Bronsted Lowry then gave you a new definition of acids and bases and talked about proton transfer, where you looked at it as something that donates a proton and something that accepts a proton. And then we decided that Bronsted Lowry was no longer sufficient, and we needed a way to be able to explain other types of acids and bases. And so we went to the Lewis model, and you had Lewis acids and Lewis bases. And there we explained the Lewis acid and the Lewis base in terms of the definition of the electrons and what was donating and receiving electrons. And that took over our definition of acid and base. But, you know, if you looked under the hood at the Lewis definition, Lewis encompassed everything that was Bronsted-Lowry. And Bronsted-Lowry encompassed everything that was Arrhenius. And so it was layer upon layer. And we're doing the same thing with molecular orbital theory. We're just doing a new layer that encompasses everything that came before it and will allow us to put it into new context. That's what we're doing here. Okay, so let me take that idea of molecular orbital theory. And the problem with molecular orbital theory is that it's so complicated that you really need a computer to be able to do the computation. That this is not a computation that you can do by hand in any reasonable amount of time. I mean, like years. And you can't visualize it on a piece of paper without doing the computations or having the computer go through and do the computations. And so visualization of it is extremely hard. So what we're going to do is we're going to focus just on the Pi system. And as we focus just on the Pi system, the way that we will understand the Pi system is the number of P orbitals. These would be the atomic P orbitals. Equals the number of orbitals out. So I'm using MO just to represent molecular orbitals. Let's keep it in capital so we understand that it's an abbreviation. And when we look at that, number of atomic orbitals in equals the number of molecular orbitals out. That is true for all molecular orbital theory, that if I take all of the atomic orbitals going in, not just the p orbitals, but all of the atomic orbitals in, that will equal the number of molecular orbitals out. But what I'm interested in is that if we take a look at a molecule, and there may be more orbitals above this, and there may be more orbitals below this, and I draw the barycenter, which is the division between the bonding and the antibonding. That the system that I'm interested in, that I want to focus on, is a system that resides here. And this part of the system is just the Pi system. And the Pi system is governed, you know, we have said that, let's take another idea or another concept that we used when we were doing mass spec. And we had a carbonyl, and we knocked an electron off. Which electron did we knock off? We knocked off one of the pi electrons. It was this electron that's now missing. Why did we knock off the pi electron? The pi electron, the lone pair, is the valence electron. The valence electrons are the highest molecular orbital energy electrons. We lost a valence. These are the valence electrons. And the pi system, similarly, is those electrons, which are the farthest out electrons, because think about what a p orbital is. A p orbital takes and puts the electrons on the outside of the molecule, not between two atoms, but outside of two atoms. That makes them higher in energy, and they are the highest energy electron system. And so what we're interested in here is we're interested in this system. We're interested in these guys here, which are my highest energy electrons, my valence electrons, and their corresponding antibonding orbitals. And we're interested in looking at that system. And we need to know what that system looks like relative. Fortunately, there's a model that helps us predict what that looks like, and it's called Frost Circle. Frost Circle is a model that predicts the relative energies of the pi system. In an aromatic molecule. That's what Frost Circle is. And what we do with Frost Circle is that when we draw a ring system, we always put the point of the ring system down. So if that's a six-membered ring system, then we would do it that way. If it's a five-membered ring system, we do it that way. If it's a four-membered ring system, we do it that way. One of the points always goes down. And then what we do is we take that system for which the point is going down. Let's take a six-membered ring system. And at each of the apexes of the ring system, these lines that I'm drawing represent the relative energies of the pi system. This would be psi 1, psi 2, psi 3, psi 4, psi 5, and psi 6. Then what I do is I take the number of pi electrons. Oh, and I also understand that this is the dividing line between antibonding and bonding. Then what I do is I take the number of pi electrons which are in the system. And for this system, benzene, there were six pi electrons. And I place those six pi electrons into my energy diagram in exactly the same way that I would any other energy diagram. I follow all the standard energy diagram rules that you learned in Chem 1A when you were, or even Chem 3, when you learned how to do atomic orbitals and placing in electrons into the atomic orbitals. I place those electrons in, starting with the lowest energy level. And when I have redundant energies, such as psi 2 and psi 3, I would first place electrons in across the redundant orbitals, one electron in each orbital because electrons repel. And then once I'm done filling that redundant orbital, then I go back and I start to pair them up, spin down. And when I place all six pi electrons into this system, what I find is that all the bonding orbitals are full and all the antibonding orbitals are empty. This is antibonding. These are empty. And that's what I want to see, is I want to see that I'm placing electrons into the bonding orbitals and that they are all full. And I want to see that the antibonding orbitals are empty. Okay, so let's take the system that was the Furan system that we were just looking at. And let's look at that Furan system by Frost Circle. So here's the Furan system. And in that Furan system, I had these guys that were in the pi system, and I had these electrons which are not in the pi system. And if I use Frost Circle, I've put the point down, and with the point down, what I can do is then take, and at each of the corners, each of the apexes, I put my orbitals. This becomes psi one, psi two, psi three, this is psi four, and this is psi five. And the division between bonding and antibonding in a five-membered ring system falls at this location. And as I place my pi electrons, which are within the system, into this, what I find is that all of the bonding orbitals are occupied. My bonding are full, and my antibonding are empty. Let me take and show, because I'm running up against that hour and a half. I didn't want this to go much more than an hour and a half. Let me take and show two examples that had charges in them and show how this is different. Let's compare. The five-membered ring system with a negative charge versus the five-membered ring system with a positive charge. Okay, so what's the difference between these systems? This one has six pi electrons, and this one has four pi electrons. Now, besides not fitting within the 4n plus 2, because remember the 4n plus 2 rules, 4n plus 2 rule says 2 electrons, 6 electrons, 10 electrons, that these are my allowed numbers for aromaticity, right? And so the 6 pi electrons matches here, but the 4 pi electrons doesn't match. So it's predicted that the cation should not be aromatic because it doesn't fit the right number of electrons. But why is it, molecular orbital theory wise, why does that not work? It's fully conjugated. This system should be fully aromatic, but yet it doesn't work. So when we look at Frost Circle, and we get a prediction of where the molecular orbitals are going to be, what we do is we take and we put, I'm going to switch out of red. We take and we put the system point side down. We draw in the orbitals. It's the same for the other system. The orbitals look identical, and they should, because they're both five-membered ring systems, right? So we've got both orbitals in both systems. However, what we find is that in the first system, we have the negative charge, which is the extra electrons. So let's do it this way. Let's say that this is the extra electrons and that that constitutes the negative charge that is that molecule. This one has a carbocation, no extra electrons within the system. The barycenter for both of these is the same location. The bonding orbitals are below that line. The antibonding are above that line. And as I go in and I fill in the electrons into the system, what I find is that the right-hand system is not fully saturated with electrons within the bonding orbitals. And this is what is called a diradical, and acts like a diradical and is extra reactive because of that diradical. Whereas this one is full and is aromatic. And what's missing over here are the two electrons that would complete it. And so it's missing two electrons for aromatic. Does that help to highlight why the two are different? To see understanding where the orbitals are and filling the orbitals such that we're filling all of the bonding orbitals? Because remember, when a bonding orbital is not full, when a bonding orbital is disrupted, that weakens the molecule and makes the molecule more reactive because it doesn't have the stability that it needs. And it makes a lot more sense all of a sudden when you see why that happens. Let's take the four-membered ring system. If you can give me just a couple more minutes, because this also highlights it and makes just a beautiful example. Let's take that four-membered ring system. I said that this system was not aromatic, that this system was anti-aromatic. And in fact, when you look at this system actually has two long bonds and two short bonds. And when you measure it spectroscopically, the bond distances, this one is long and this one is short. And that is counter to what we think of for most aromatic molecules. If we took the aromatic molecule benzene, all the bond angles are exactly the same length. There's no difference. This bond and this bond are the same length. Okay, so what's going on here is that if I take the four-membered ring system and do Frost circle with it, what we find is that in this system, the barycenter resides here. And what you have is you have four pi electrons. And when you stack those four pi electrons into it, two of those pi electrons are in antibonding orbitals. Anytime we've stuck electrons into antibonding orbitals, that always destabilizes the molecule. These guys are the bonding ones. And so this molecule is destabilized because it has electrons which are in antibonding orbitals. Okay, so one of the other molecules that I said that was aromatic, I need just a little bit more room here. Let me take this guy, move it up. This guy, move it up. And let me draw one more that I said was aromatic that was really kind of interesting. The dication, having both of these have the positive charge. Well, what does that do? That takes a molecule and puts two empty p orbitals. These guys here constitute the positive charges, and both of them are empty p orbitals. But the empty p orbitals allow for conjugation within the system. And when I take a look at that system and I do Frost circle, the same analysis for it as I did over here, and I look at the difference between bonding and antibonding, and I look at my two positive charges that reside here, that means I get two electrons in the system. And that's it. There's only two pi electrons. And yet the system is flat and fully conjugated because these guys here are sp2 hybridized and empty with their positive charges, allowing for full conjugation and only two pi electrons in the system, which are the two bonding. And the antibonding are empty, as they should be. Which makes this guy aromatic. And all bond angles and lengths the same. And this one anti-aromatic. Too many R's. There we go. Makes that one anti-aromatic. And I can understand it from the prospect of Frost circle and how the electrons fill into the system. So Frost circle is going to be one of our primary ways of looking at a structure and determining whether or not that structure is aromatic by looking at how many pi electrons can fit within it and the orientation. But it's not the only thing, right? It has to be flat. It has to be all sp2 hybridized. It has to be fully conjugated. And it has to have 4n plus 2 pi electrons And it has to fit within frost circle. And those are all of our things that will allow us to be able to determine what is aromatic and what is not aromatic. And then we'll start to look at chemical reactions that aromatic molecules can undergo. So all of this has been, this lecture has just been to describe what is aromaticity and how we needed to go to a deeper level of theory to understand aromaticity. And now it's going back to looking at molecules. I wanted to go to the picture of this guy and understanding that there are many different types of molecules that we can draw that are aromatic. That some of them will have positive charges, some of them will have negative charges, some of them will have particular elements like boron, which are isoelectronic with a positive charge. Some of them will not be aromatic, despite them looking like they should be. And it all comes down to having the right number of electrons and whether or not they fit in with frost circle analysis. So that's our aromaticity lecture. As you can see, aromaticity is one of those things that I just find immensely fascinating and really fun to look at, because it's so much about being able to visualize the molecular orbitals and the orientation of those orbitals and knowing where those orbital shapes project and which of the electrons are within the pi system and which are not. And structure is governed not by simple rules like Vesper theory. It's not that simple. It's much more about electronic stability and molecular orbital stability. And that's what governs geometry. And so hybridization is not a function of repulsion of electrons per se, but more so a function of stability, and that the molecule will assume whatever geometry is most stable for it based on molecular orbital theory and what is most stable for the electrons. That's what it comes down to. And that's, we've learned something new. So that's really cool. Anyway, all right. I'm up against that time deadline. I went a little bit long, not long for lab. You guys are used to it, but a little bit long for lecture. But I want to catch any questions. If there's any questions that you guys might have at this point, after going through and doing that, you guys were pretty quiet during the lecture. But what came up here? Anything?
I have a super quick language question, I guess. When you say anti-aromatic, is that different from just simply non-aromatic, or is it specifically like against aromatic or something?
Yeah, what we use for not aromatic is something that is aliphatic, that breaks the rules in other ways. Stable molecules that the stability of the molecule does, it may have resonance in it, it may have other things, but it doesn't have aromatic arrangement. So we use not aromatic for all those aliphatic things. Anti-aromatic is used to explain something that is less stable than an aromatic molecule. That has all of the same properties. It's fully conjugated, it's flat, it's in a ring system. That's the other thing that I didn't put in here that should have been in here, is that the system needs to be in a ring. And yet it has the wrong number of electrons that leads to it being less stable because it's a diradical, or because it doesn't have all of the bonding electrons filled in some way that causes the molecule to be more reactive, not less reactive. So anti-aromatic says all of these things that make it look aromatic, but it's much less stable than aromatic because it doesn't have the right number of electrons.
Okay, thank you. That makes sense.
Cool. Anybody else have anything? I'm sure things will come up. Oftentimes with a new lecture like this, it's shock and awe. It takes a little while to process, and then all the questions come out in the second lecture, and that's okay too. All right, if there's no further questions, let's go ahead and cut it here, and we'll take a break. I'll be back online for 11 for office hours, and I'm getting a phone call from someplace, and I'll get that later. All right, let me go ahead and stop the share, stop the recording. And